I was emotionally struggling with my life purpose, what I was achieving in my career and so on. And I realized I've gotten to a place most don't get to get to. And that's one of the reasons I want to share this message with the world is if I can help someone else get to that more joyful place in their career, I want to do that.
Hi, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Swan.
And I'm Tracy O'Rourke.
We are from GoingSixSigma.com, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast, where we wrestle with tough questions, talk to thought leaders, discuss great books with their authors, and get insights from Lean Six Sigma practitioners.
And we let you in on helpful apps, bring you the news, and challenge the status quo so you can build your problem-solving muscles. So, Elizabeth, what's on the menu today? Because I'm hungry for some Info McNuggets.
Info McNuggets coming up, Tracy. The highlight of this episode is that I got to interview Richard Sheridan of Menlo Innovations. This is Richard's second visit to the cafe because he's just written his second book, Chief Joy Officer. He is changing the image of what's possible in corporate work life, so you do not want to miss that conversation. For today's app, we'll cover a Chrome extension that is changing the game for how we switch between websites. And for Q&A, we entertain a forum question asking for tips on waste walks. And for the printed page, we take an in-depth look at Richard Sheridan's new book that provides guidance for leaders looking to elevate human energy and eliminate fear in the workforce. It's a great day at the cafe, Tracy.
So remember to stay tuned for this month's coupon code in order to get a discount on GoLeanSixSigma.com's online training.
Let's get to that appetizer.
So this Chrome extension actually provides visual management for web browsing, doesn't it?
It does. So it's called Toby, and it is a Google Chrome extension, free of course, and it lets you store sets of tabs, browser tabs, so you can open a suite of sites depending on what you need to do. First off, this assumes you use Chrome as your preferred browser. It's our preferred browser. We recommend that it's your preferred browser. And Google's claim is that it's better than bookmarks. I'd say it's got a different function than bookmarks, but it allows you to organize your browser tabs. And if you are like us, you probably have dozens open at once. And if you're like us, there are some you always want open for certain tasks. Most recently, Tracy and I have been upgrading our Greenbelt training. So I looked at it and I realized that requires a tab for the page we're editing, a tab for the learning management system to see it in real time, a tab for the card with all the project information, a tab for our own template download page, a tab for the work in process folder as we update templates. And I usually have a thesaurus open because you know I love words, Tracy.
I know, you love words. And I love that you love words.
I know. So when switching between tasks, like getting ready to interview a guest on this show or developing the next webinar, I generally spend a few minutes searching for each tab that I need, and that takes time.
Yes, and the way it works is that you drag your open tabs into a set area, you designate all the tabs you need for a particular task, and that means it creates a visual workplace so you can see your different tab sets and what's in them. It's also an example of changeover reduction, also called setup reduction, SMED, single minute exchange of die, for you manufacturing people, and other names. Changeover reduction is the art of reducing the time it takes to switch from producing one type of product or service to another product or service. This is classically considered non-value add time, and the term originally comes from manufacturing, like I said, but one way to reduce changeover is to create something called presets. Presets are settings that apply to a particular service or a task. It's a shortcut. You create presets for each task. That's what Toby lets you do with these browser tabs. You just hit the tab set you need and close the ones you're finished with. The staff was using something called pin tabs, our staff, to do the same thing, but they switched because Toby is shareable. So Elizabeth created all this work to create this wonderful folder or preset, and I get to use it.
Yes, I shared my Greenbelt 4.0 presets with you. And then I get notices when the staff shares their presets with me for different projects that we're on. So I can look at my list by myself, or I can look at the expanded team list. So it's a nice add. You could also use it to create a batch of sites that you want to check out. I have a habit of saving blogs, articles, you know, potential webinars from other people that I want to read or engage in, but I can just drag those into a collection of presets called things I want to check out. And then I can remove them as I finish them. So having that list visible means it's way more likely that I'll actually read them. So I'm looking for it. Yeah, I think it's
that's
a good one.
That's a great idea. I love that. I'm stealing that.
Steal it.
As a matter of fact, why don't you just share it with me and I'll read whatever you read.
Ooh, I hadn't even thought about that. That is awesome. Thumbs up on this one, Tracy, right?
Absolutely. Two thumbs up.
I'm Elizabeth Swan and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. Up next, it's Q&A.
This forum question came about waste walks led to a whole new webinar. So there's a lot to discuss, isn't there, Elizabeth?
Yeah, the question was, what goes into a waste walk or a good waste walk? And this was such a good question, we decided to build a whole webinar around it. So if you missed that, you'll see a link for it with this podcast. Let's start with the definition of a waste walk. It's a structured visit to a workspace or a process to observe and identify the eight wastes with the goal of uncovering continuous improvement opportunities. So it's different from a process walk, which is also known as a Gemba walk, which is a series of interviews with process participants to collect data about a process going to each process step. So the waste walk is traditionally observational, and the goal is to identify each of the eight wastes. That's defects, overproduction, waiting, non-utilized talent, transportation, inventory, motion, or extra processing. The handy acronym downtime capsulizes the eight wastes. But what are some of your thoughts on waste walks, Tracy?
I love waste walks, and I really think everybody should do them, not just at work. I think the biggest challenge we run into is people don't see waste. And the more you do waste walks and the more you look for waste, the better you're going to be at identifying waste. And so you can always practice. You go to lunch somewhere, observe the waste in the process. You could go anywhere and observe waste in the process and see if you can find it. And then I think it's also interesting to, you know, explore those root causes and then potential solutions.
Yeah. I think I like what you say about getting the habit of identifying the eight wastes. You know, when you're out and about, you're getting a sandwich, you're ordering, you're at the Department of Motor Vehicles. And if that's where you are, I'm really sorry. But anyway, you'll be able to identify waste. But I think a caveat is you don't want to be too loud about it. So you want to identify them. And the idea is in your own processes or in your own home, you know, make notes. And as Tracy says, look for opportunities to come up with ways to solve them. And those could be really minor to, you know, there's an easier way to do this, or I could just turn something off, turn it on, or it could be a bigger deal when you want to go do a new project. Actually, waste walks are a great way to come up with ideas for improvement efforts. You know, you could be using DMAIC, you could be using PDCA, you could be doing a Kaizen, you know, a rapid improvement event. You could do a 5S. The result of a waste walk might be, you know what, let's just 5S this workspace. But yes. Yeah, so it's a great way to get that. But I think the idea is, as we differentiate between waste walk and process walk, it's observational. You're taking those notes, you're coming back and you're discussing, okay, what could we do with the people in the process, right, Tracy? You don't want to do improvement to somebody.
Yes. It reminds me of this awesome project I had the pleasure of viewing yesterday called You Stole My Bike. In this project, this is at UC Santa Barbara, they wanted to reduce the amount of time it took to retrieve your bike. If you got your bike impounded because maybe you didn't park it in the right spot, it would get impounded. And then people going to retrieve their bike, they coined that term for their project because that's the first thing people said when they would come in. You stole my bike. So
I love the name.
Yeah, they're already mad at you because you took their bike. And now it could take up to an hour to find your bike. And even though we found the bike or they found your bike, you might actually leave without your bike because you can't show proof of registration. It was a very interesting project. And the waste that they really uncovered was the walking. Looking for the bike took up the most amount of time. And they ended up reducing it to, you know, it was 90% of the process time and they reduced it significantly. So that was really interesting. And so it was a really good project.
That was great. I love that one. Well, thanks for that example. I just saw that on LinkedIn, You Stole My Bike. So it's like, I did want to know what the heck was that project, because it sounds great. So great question. As I mentioned, it led to a webinar. If you didn't get a chance to join that webinar, click on the link where the podcast is listed.
I'm Tracy O'Rourke, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. In a short while, we'll get to hear Elizabeth's interview with Richard Sheridan, CEO of Menlo Innovations and author of the new book, Chief Joy Officer. But first, it's the printed page. So Richard Sheridan is the new joy guru, isn't he?
He is. I told him that's what he was. And this is his second book. And having spoken to him, I know it's not his last, which is also kind of exciting, which is good news for everyone. His first book, Joy Incorporated, which we reviewed here at the cafe, you can also find a detailed review of that one on our website, was all about how he came to co-found Menlo Innovations, the software development company in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Joy Incorporated covered the innovative and joyous culture of paired programmers, zero hierarchy, and no walls, which was great. Tracy, you and I got to tour Menlo and meet Richard and the entire company last year.
Yes, it clearly felt different right away. As you mentioned, the open space, it was clear to see pairs of people working together. Dogs and kids were also in the mix. And we got to see some really innovative work practices and processes, like visual boards on pay grade and the peer approval process in order to get an increase in pay. Those are pretty innovative things.
Yeah, no, good recap, Tracy. So this new book, Chief Joy Officer, is a guide for leaders who want a joyous culture like the one that they've achieved at Menlo Innovation. So part one is all about the principles and the values that drive leadership in this culture. And it involves things like being authentic. And that was a great thing to read about because it just uncovers the assumptions that drive a lot of cultural norms. Some of these things feel like they're holdovers from the 70s, but this idea that leaders have to know it all, they have to have an answer for everything, they have to be always strong, always confident, never wavering. What's actually more effective is acknowledging our humanity. We don't always have all the answers. We're learning too. Leaders do get stressed. They do worry. That's part of the job. And letting people know who you really are improves trust, doesn't it?
It really does. And I think you're right. I think leaders assume they have to be almost perfect. And we are not perfect. When you are vulnerable and you let people know that you're struggling or that you're actually trying to learn something and you've got opportunities yourself, you're just being a good role model and you are building trust and you are allowing other people to be vulnerable by doing that. And I think saying be vulnerable to a leader is threatening to people sometimes. They don't want to be that leader. And I think it'll take a little while for people to, I think people are getting more comfortable with that idea now.
I think so too. And another value that he lists is patience. And as a result of the pressure and stress we just talked about on leaders, they often default to what's expedient. So it's natural to work toward efficiency and short-term results. We might get something done faster, but we miss out on helping others grow. So a little patience now means we are growing future leaders who can help us down the road, allowing others to build their skills. And yes, that's something I know everyone struggles with. I mean, even just coaching, right? You can see the answer. You know how you can help them if you just explain, just do X. But if you hold back and let someone discover it for themselves, it's a way more powerful learning for them, right?
Absolutely. That's what we talk about with problem solving all the time is they have to be able to make mistakes. They have to be able to experiment. It has to be okay to actually fail. We talk about that all the time. And that is hard for leaders. You know, they want to catch their people. They care. And sometimes that means they feel like they need to save their people when they're actually enabling them.
Yeah, and they need permission to fail because it's, you know, they don't want to fail either. It's that, you know, it looks bad, but you have to make it okay to fail because honestly, those are the times that we learn the best. Failure, I think, those are the best lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So the second part of the book is putting those values and principles into practice. One of my favorite chapters is titled, Pursue Systems, Not Bureaucracy. And he quotes a lot of people, but he's got a great classic Dr. Deming quote, management's overall aim should be to create a system in which everybody may take joy in his work. And I think the key word there is system. And you and I know the value of simple, repeatable, measurable systems, which is easier said than done. That reminds me of a story. I know I've brought it up on the podcast before, but we were running a workshop, our fast pitch workshop up in Canada, and it's a simulation, lots of moving parts. I went to pass out the pencils to the participants, and the pencils were completely brand new, which is great, but they were completely unsharpened, which was bad. We scrambled, client helped out, we got the pencil sharpened, everything worked. But I got back to the office and I asked Darian, who put the packages together, thank you, Darian, if he could let me know what the packaging instructions said about packing the pencils. And he asked, what was it about? I explained the pencils came unsharpened, which was an issue, so I wanted to check the instructions. And he began to apologize for his mistake, and I stopped him and I said, yeah, but what does it say? And he said, it says to pack enough for the group. And I said, it doesn't mention sharpening, right? And he says, no. And I said, well, then the process is flawed and we need to add a step to sharpen pencils. You know, we didn't set him up for success. And he made a really funny remark. He said, oh, that's a really interesting way to look at things. And I said to him, no, it's the only way to look at things, you know, blaming people is a waste of time and energy. You know, the leader's job is to create this blame-free atmosphere so people can get to fixing the process as fast as possible, right? We waste time with blame. So it's better for employees and leaders and customers if we get there faster.
Cool. I think we are very process focused, and I'm happy to say that. And we do really focus on the process and not our people. And I'm really proud of that. And I hope that everybody gets to work in a place like that.
Hear, hear.
Richard Sheridan is definitely a role model for any leader wanting to transform their organization into a healthy culture where many things thrive, including continuous improvement. So if you need a role model, if you're a leader that wants to be better at leading, you should definitely read Richard's books and follow him. It's a wonderful book full of great stories and guidance. So please review Elizabeth's full review on our website because it is awesome and it'll make you want to read the book.
Thanks, Tracy.
Okay, it's time to announce the coupon code.
This code is for 20% off any of our Lean Six Sigma training and certification courses. That's white belt, yellow belt, green belt, black belt, and lean training.
If you've joined us at the Just in Time Cafe, just use coupon code 20LEMON. That's 20LEMON. And that really sounds yummy right now for my cold. During checkout, make sure to use it soon since the coupon code will expire at the end of April.
Yes, you use the code. Tracy, you put it in your tea.
Definitely. Coming up next is today's special. Elizabeth, give us a little preview of your interview with Richard Sheridan.
Yeah, Tracy, as you can tell, I'm a mega fan, but Richard's in a unique position of running a company that's unlike any other. There's no bosses. Peers decide each other's promotions. They are totally unafraid to try new things, and the result is a super successful company with a joyous culture. What's great is he's so happy to share what he's learned with other leaders. He knows it's different for everyone, but he's cracked the code by experimenting, you know, with different leadership models. He's also a great storyteller, so definitely listen in. Hi, and welcome to today's special. We've got a friend of the show back with us today, Richard Sheridan, co-founder and CEO of Menlo Innovations and author of the new best-selling book, Chief Joy Officer. Richard is a big celebrity in the process excellence community. Welcome back, Richard.
Great to be here, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Richard wrote the book Joy Incorporated about 5 years ago about the culture at Menlo Innovations. And Richard and Menlo have been featured in Forbes, Inc., Entrepreneur, and New York magazines. They were also a case study in the Toyota Way to Process Excellence by Jeff Leiker and Karen Ross. Richard started Menlo Innovations back in 2001 with a mission to end human suffering in the world as it relates to technology by returning joy to one of the most unique endeavors mankind has ever undertaken, the invention of software. Menlo plays host to over 4,000 people a year who want to see this joyous culture in action. Richard travels the world speaking about joy, creativity, and human energy in the workplace. I think, as I said, Richard, you are now a joy guru. Tracy and I got to tour Menlo Innovations and interview Richard last year. And now that Chief Joy Officer is out, I'm excited to get a second interview. Thanks for being game, Richard.
You bet. My pleasure.
So whereas your first book detailed the journey to the joyous culture you guys have at Menlo, this new book outlines the role of a leader in building and supporting that culture. So what inspired you to write this time? I've just found out Karen Martin inspired you to write the first time.
She did. Karen is a great friend. And when Karen tells you to do something, ultimately you're going to do it. No question. Shout out to you, Karen Martin, if you're listening to this. Yeah, so the second book was really a lot of questions I was getting as I toured the world speaking about joy in the context of business, which is a weird concept. I like being the joy guru now. That's I'll tell everybody that Elizabeth Swan gave me that title. although I don't get to sit up on the mountaintop very often. So this is a guru that's still down in the business working through everything every day.
Humble guru.
Yeah, there you go. The questions people ask me after I would give talks is, you know, a lot of them were, how do we get started? Where do we go from here? How do we get from where we are today to where we want to go? And it invariably would involve a discussion on visionary leadership. What is the role of a leader inside of a joyful organization? There was a chapter inside of Joy Inc. called Growing Leaders, Not Bosses. And it talked about the fact that we had a non-hierarchical organization here, which is odd, unusual. We don't have bosses here. I get that that wouldn't work most places. So certainly not advocating a non-hierarchical workplace, but that's what we have. But I think because we peeled away the hierarchy here, we can spend a lot more time talking about what does it mean to actually be a leader, because in fact, leaders are are the path to developing the organization, to getting things done, to coaching and teaching, to serving others. And that's really what allowed this new book to be birthed and to come into the world.
The lack of hierarchy was striking in your first book and striking on visiting Menlo and seeing the kind of the artifacts of it on the walls and in the folks you had there. And I'm sure as everyone else does, you read these books and now reading your second book, I'm challenged in my thinking once again, like, well, how could you take more of this into your own culture? You know, I am a leader. I believe in the humble servant leadership that you talk about. I know that we embrace a lot of what's part of your culture, but then I look at things like, you know, we recently discussed that paired programming, that article that came out about Google and their two revered top programmers are the only ones that program in pairs, and everyone assumes, well, they did it, they're special, but no one else can do that. And you guys, obviously, that's part of what makes your organization a learning organization, is that you have these pairs and they switch. And then I thought, but we don't program, so what do we do? But in Chief Joy Officer, you talk about that you've paired up even folks that aren't programmers. So I wanted to understand that better. How does that work?
Yeah, in the early days, the only people we paired on our team were the programmers. That was born out of a book by a guy named Kent Beck on practice he dubbed Extreme Programming. And it was a wonderful book and greatly changed my thinking about how programming teams could be organized. And at a certain point, as we began to see more deeply all the benefits of paired programming, and we could talk about those if you want, we started to recognize that many of those benefits weren't translating into the rest of the team. We started developing the same problems that we were trying to solve with paired programming, for instance, towers of knowledge, or someone trapped on a particular project because no one else knew what they knew. And so we ran the experiment, which is a famous phrase here at Menlo, to pair a role that does no programming at all. We call it high-tech anthropologist, and the practice of Menlo that really allows us to end human suffering in the world as it relates to technology is the role of our high-tech anthropologists. And so we started pairing them, and they had all the same complaints and same pushback and same reasons that wouldn't work as the original programmers that I had convinced to try this back at my old company, Interface Systems. So it's hilarious to me that here's a company, you know, here we are at Menlo, we're probably 2 or 3 years old at this point, We've been pairing our programmers from the first day. And now we go to introduce pairing again to a different part of the team. And they all look and go, well, that wouldn't work for us. Well, I mean, we're special. We're different. We're doing creative work. Like, really? Like, programming isn't creative work. And so James and I, in our polite but firm way, ignored their pleas, and we started pairing them. And I can tell you now, if you talk to any of our high-peak anthropologists today, they couldn't imagine doing work unless it was done in pairs. Now we paired our QA team, our QA team members, and we loosely pair our project managers. I think we could do a tighter coupling there than we do. And I have found over the years, the greatest weaknesses inside of Menlo occur in the places we are not pairing. And so I will just simply say it is probably the most powerful managerial paradigm I will ever discover in my life.
Interesting that you ran into the classic, we call it NIH or not invented here, like that. That's not how the technical anthropologists work. Like, that might be for programmers, but that's not us.
Right.
And that's a constant that we run into with continuous improvement. Like, well, may have worked in that hotel, but it's not going to work in this hotel. It's a very different hotel.
You might imagine all of our visitors here, most of them really like what they see. They're intrigued. They're kind of captivated by Menlo. But at the very end, they're like, yeah, you guys are so lucky that you get to do this, because it would never work for us because we're too, and just fill in the blank. We're too big, we're too small, we're too young, we're too old, we're too regulated, we're too unregulated, we're too governmental, we're a manufacturing organization, we're a non-manufacturing organization. And people often ask me, they said, well, all the people who come in, who are the people who are utterly convinced it would never work for them? I said, oh, that's easy. People, yeah. Software.
That's, and I think that's kind of a great way to look at it, is because I'm from that world of, well, you know, run the experiment. Let's challenge it. How would you do it? As opposed to all the reasons you can't, like, well, how could you? So, and we have another challenge, which is we are not co-located. I just watched a documentary of Pixar, and the idea that you had of pulling everybody under the same roof, having one big open room and allowing that bump up of minds and ideas, and the fact that people can hear each other in that room just completely supports it being a learning organization. And that's the ideal. So we've already made tweaks, so I think we could make some more. So I'm going to take that as a challenge and see how that might work. But another question I have for you is, you were, I think, troubled by losing programmers. And I wanted to know, to talk more about that and what you think is behind that.
Yeah. So a lot of people ask us about attrition here at Menlo, and because a lot of them think, oh, you've got a joyful culture. People are happy every minute of every day, which is untrue. And you must have zero attrition. And first of all, I think any organization that has zero attrition is in big trouble. It's the anti-joy measure. I think you, I'm not saying attrition is high attrition is good, but zero attrition would be probably terrible. In fact, I've seen a lot of organizations that have zero attrition, and they're probably some of the worst performing organizations I've ever seen, because usually what happens when you have zero attrition is you hang on to people unnaturally, and you tend to move them around in your organization. Oh, they're not working in this department. Let's move them over to that department. And, rather than perhaps the best thing that could happen is they move on. And so we do lose people here. Absolutely. We're never perfectly happy about it when it happens. But the other part of Menlo that I think is important to understand in that change is that we will invite them back. We will welcome them back should they choose to reapply and want to rejoin our team. So we're a bit of a birdcage without bars. We don't try and hang on to people unnaturally, and we don't resist them unnaturally should they ever choose to return. Doesn't mean everybody who left can come back, or maybe even some of those we've asked to leave along the way. And I think I tell a story in Chief Joy Officer Ian, who has left three times and come back every time. I think he's on his fourth tour here. And I know when I wrote that in the book, my editor says, oh, you have to tell me what happened there, because who let somebody come back four times? But it was an interesting progression and evolution for Ian and for Memel along the way.
I think you had Ian come and speak to us when we toured, and that also left an impression on me. And I believe what you say in terms of attrition is normal and natural, but it shifted my thinking around when we lost somebody to lay the groundwork that they were always welcome back, to make sure that they knew that that door remained open, you know, wherever they went. And just, I think what you experienced was they learned more out there. Ian learned new skills and brought back, you know, sort of new thinking, and was enriching the culture and the organization.
Yeah. I mean, he goes out, he has different experiences. He comes back here. And I will tell you, the first time was kind of delightful when he decided to come back. He was a completely different Ian than when he left. I'm pretty frank about it in the book, and frank about it with Ian when he's with me, is that we were going to fire him. He was on the edge of insubordination in those early days, and he admits it. He didn't believe in everything we did here. He thought we were over the top on so many different things, and he thought we could do things differently. And James and I, in some regards, will refuse to budge from time to time because we so deeply believe in many of the approaches we take, born out of our own experiences of both seeing what went wrong in the past and how much things got better when we made the changes we did. And Ian this was his first job, and he just didn't believe what we believed. And when he came back the second time, he was completely different Ian. And I asked him what happened. And he said, well, Rich, when I got out there, he says, you know, I had my own thoughts on how to do things. And I started seeing the problems that you and James described. And he says, every time I came up with a solution for one of those problems, I realized I was slowly but surely rebuilding Menlo. And then he kind of jokingly looks at me and says, do you know how hard it is to build a Menlo? And he says, one day I woke up and he's like, why am I rebuilding Menlo when I could go work at Menlo? And that's when he came back. And of course, he was very different at that point. But now he had this real world experience. I mean, I get it. I mean, people who never experienced the pain and suffering that James and I did in my own career, in our own careers, don't know why we do the things we do. Might think they're over the top. Might think we could, you know, we could unpair people. We could work remotely and from home and all that sort of thing. Why are they so hell bent on keeping us all together in a big room?
You just mentioned, you know, the pain or the reasons you started Menlo, or the idea of like, do you know how hard it is to build it? And one thing that strikes me, because in the process improvement world, even at a very simple level, we are constantly working with folks on, you know, if this is the problem, what does it solve? And why does it matter? You know, how does this relate to the, basically the purpose of your organization? You know, why does the organization exist? And then let's see how this relates, and could, you know, even if it took a few layers to get there, how does this impact the mission and purpose of the organization? And often, as I think you may experience, people don't even know the missions of their organizations. They're searching on websites. Is there a purpose statement? Is there a mission statement? Like, what? Why does this organization exist?
Posted on the bathroom wall.
Yeah, right. And one thing that still resonates with me is your clear and present purpose. And I can repeat it from memory, and I often do repeat it, you know, from memory to give people examples of a compelling mission. And there was an article in the Times recently by Charles Duhigg, who wrote The Power of Habit. And he had just gone to his Harvard Business School 15th reunion. And he was really surprised at how miserable a lot of his classmates were, well-paid and miserable. And this isn't going to surprise you, but, you know, a lot of them sort of didn't know, you know, what am I doing it for? What is the point of this? And they all relayed that at a certain point the money stopped mattering because they didn't really know what it was for. And my question for you, because this is back in 2001, and what got you to form such a clear purpose statement? What got you there?
15 years of pain. you know, my life journey started out as a programmer in the earliest days of my life. I was 13 when I wrote my first code. I got a job while I was still in high school, and I couldn't believe people would pay me to do this thing I just loved to do as a hobby. Graduated from Michigan in 82 with a couple of degrees in computer science, computer engineering. Launched a career, and I thought, man, this career is going to carry me for a lifetime. I'm good at it. I love it. This is so fun. You know, it's so creative. You can build new things. But very quickly realized that the pain of the industry, where we're blowing budgets, missing deadlines, delivering crappy quality to the world, you know, and I'm sure you and I share a love for great Deming quotes. And one of my favorite is that all anyone asks for is a chance to work with pride. Mm. And I never, ever got that. And so after a while, the money becomes the only thing that matters. And I will tell you, money is a horrible salve for a bad career. And so I began digging my way out. And I started reading books on management, on organizational design, on design thinking, on different ways of doing things with customer, because I wanted to get back to why I chose this profession in the first place. And what I've come to learn about engineers in particular, I'll speak for my engineering brethren and sistren, and that is that there's only one reason you truly get into engineering, I believe, and it is to delight the people you intend to serve, that you want somebody later to stop you and say, that thing, you worked on that, you got to design and build that, I love that. You made my life better because of that. And unfortunately, many of us, particularly in the software industry, never get that experience. Software regularly tortures you. People, I hate this software. Why does it work like this? Did they ever talk to somebody like me? And the answer is probably not. But we get to produce that kind of delight in the people we serve. And so when it finally sort of, when I finally had my own kind of, you know, epiphany moment in all of this, well, what do I really, really want? I was willing to trade away all the worldly trappings for this pursuit of joy. Now, I can tell you it's worked out well. But if it hadn't, I probably would have gotten out of the industry entirely, because I was in my late 30s by this point, and I looked ahead and I said, I can't do this for another 20 or 30 years and survive.
Yeah. The article mentioned something to that effect, which is the struggle. If people had to struggle, then they actually figured out what trade-offs they were willing to make and pursued things that they cared more about,
right,
as opposed to kind of this, you know, golden ticket. Like, I got a Harvard MBA. I can get in anywhere. I can make gazillions of dollars. But the happy ones didn't get picked up. They weren't the first in line to get these great jobs. So the ones that had to struggle, and your struggle was different. You actually kind of did have that golden ticket. You were at the right time. You had the right skills. You were in the right place, but the industry was hopelessly set up. So I think that's a really helpful thing, is sort of having to work through pain, struggle, I don't know, to help get there, which is kind of key. But that is the thing that people miss. And
let me tell you a funny story. I had a guy that I worked with once, named Bob, who asked me one time, he says, Rich, do you buy lottery tickets? And I said, no. And he said, why not? I said, I prefer the struggle. And it's true. I mean, I think if you pull the struggle out of people's lives, we lose our purpose. And I think, you know, again, I realize I'm speaking as someone who's led a pretty blessed life on many, many fronts. And so I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to speak too strongly into struggle, but I was emotionally struggling with my life purpose, what I was achieving in my career and so on. And I realized I've gotten to a place most don't get to get to. And that's one of the reasons I want to share this message with the world, is if I can help someone else get to that more joyful place in their career, I want to do that.
Yeah. I think of you now every time I go put my credit card into those insidious machines at checkout, you know, put your card in, keep your card in, take your card out, do the, you know, it's like barking at you or beeping or flashing. And I just think, where were the technical anthropologists for this machine?
Nowhere to be found. That machine, I have no idea where it was designed, but I can tell you, nobody actually ever watched a real human being trying to do a credit card purchase with one of those machines.
No.
There's no,
no, that
way.
That didn't happen. How long has Chief Joy Officer been out?
Since December. Came out December 4th.
Super new. Do you have is there a new next book on your horizon?
You know, I have already designed the table of contents for a book that I do want to write about entrepreneurship. I actually talked about it in Joy Inc. And I've got the whole layout. Whether this publisher supports me in writing that particular book, I don't know. But the next year or two will be consumed simply by getting on airplanes and flying to distant places on the planet to speak about Chief Joy Officer.
I hear you on that. But I love the idea of you tackling entrepreneurship, because I find that there's a different skill set for the entrepreneur, the building, the skills that it takes to build an organization versus the skills to lead a mature organization. And it'll be interesting because you've crossed both those divides. So it'll be really interesting to hear what you think about that. So what have I not asked you that you would like to tell our listeners?
You know, one of the things that probably many authors realize is when the final chapter is written and the manuscript is sent off, and then, you know, it gets edited and printed and all that, and you begin speaking about it, certain ideas start to bubble up that I think it's a natural result of having written a book. And maybe in your heart, you're like, oh, I wish I could have put that in the book. But there's been a concept that has sprung forth that I just want to encourage your listeners around. And that is, what are the forces at work on a human organization? And what, as leaders, what forces do we need to tackle in our human organizations in order to get them, as I say, off the ground? And I use a metaphor of an airplane. And it's not in the book, although there's a lot of airplane references in the book. But what I talk about, if you look at an aircraft, you look at the four forces at work on an aircraft, the lift, the weight or gravity, the thrust that pulls it forward, and the drag that holds it back. It's pretty easy to draw a parallel to that on human organizations. And I think this is what we as leaders need to be thinking about. We can talk about the lift of human energy. You felt it when you were here. That's a big part of Memlo, is keeping the human energy high. There's a lot of things we do here that work to keep human energy high. I'll steal a word from my friend, good friend and author, Karen Martin. It was on the title of her latest book, Clarity. Clarity keeps human energy high. Low ambiguity, high clarity is a big deal. The weight that holds us down, the sort of the countervailing force to high human energy, is the weight of bureaucracy. I think in many organizations, meeting load is way too high. And at a certain level of leadership or management, you're almost a human sacrifice to meetings and you're getting absolutely nothing done all day. The thrust is the thrust of purpose that carries us forward. I encourage people as they think about their organizations to think about two fundamental questions that are easy to ask, but not necessarily as easy to answer as you might think. Who do you serve and what would delight look like for them? And when I ask people to contemplate those two questions, I take the three obvious stakeholders off the table: your employees, your customers, and your investors. Of course, you have to serve them. You don't stay in business if you don't. But I want you to look past all of them, look out into the world and ask, who do we actually serve out in the world? That purpose-driven part of an organization is what allows people to re-engage with why they're there, what they're hoping to do. And then there's the drag of fear. We spend a lot of time talking about fear here at Menlo and how do we pump fear out of the room. And so those four basic forces are at work on human organizations. And the simple equation is you're never going to eliminate the weight of bureaucracy and the drag of fear. But if we can minimize those and raise the other two, our organizational aircraft will get off the ground every single day. And I think the book, if people are drawn to reading it, you're going to see a lot of examples of what we do here and what others have done, because I bring in a lot of stories from the outside world into the book as well, to lift human energy, get that thrust of purpose, reduce the amount of bureaucracy, and reduce the amount of fear inside of their organizations.
That's lovely. That was a great question. Who do you serve? How can someone find you or communicate with you if they wanted to, Richard?
Yeah. So I would encourage all of your listeners, if they can, like you did, come visit. You can probably speak passionately about the depth of what you learned when you were here. You can go to our website and sign up for a tour or a class. And just so we're clear, we do one free tour a month. So if people can't afford to pay anything for the tour itself, there is one free tour we do a month as well. But come visit. Come see us. If that is impossible, obviously read the book or the books in this case. But our website is menloinnovations.com. I can be reached by email. I'm really crazy about email. I walked over here with only 3 messages in my inbox, so I keep up with it. And I'm rsheridan@menloinnovations.com. And follow me on Twitter, menloprez with a Z. And yeah, happy to interact.
Thank you for that. Thank you for being so accessible. And yes, I encourage readers to go get a tour. It's a great learning experience, kind of unavailable anywhere else. You've been listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. My guest today has been Richard Sheridan, CEO of Menlo Innovations, author of his latest book, Chief Joy Officer. This is an uplifting read that paints a compelling picture of what's possible in the workplace. I so enjoyed reading it. Thank you so much for visiting us again, Richard.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth.
You do not want to miss Tracy's next webinar, Tidying Up with Lean Six Sigma. Also, there are still a few slots left, so if you can clear your calendar from May 11th through the 26th, come join Tracy and me on the Japan study trip with Katie Anderson. There's a few slots remaining, and it's a great way to study Lean, meet Japanese continuous improvement thought leaders, and see the beauty of Japan. And if you can't make it to Japan, you can come to Orlando, Florida, and join us for the first Global Convention of Organizational Excellence. This one is spearheaded by Shingo Prize-winning author Karen Ross, and it's a completely interactive convention focused on organizational excellence, creativity, and innovation. It features learning cohorts with keynoters, and you get to learn with colleagues from all over the world. Tracy and I are looking forward to that one, too.
And stay tuned for our next episode, where Elizabeth interviews Heather Pirshala and Mohammed Saleh of Hartford Healthcare. It's a rare conversation with a Lean Sensei and her mentor, a senior sensei, who are central figures in a major healthcare Lean transformation.
Remember, free refills at the Just in Time Cafe.
So thanks for drinking your coffee with us, and we're going to see you in 2 weeks.